From the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA, it's Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin. If you have a medical question, call us at 521-TALK. That's 521-8255. Email sundayhousecall at cfra.com. Now here's Dr. Barry Dworkin.
Good afternoon and welcome to edition number 419 of Sunday House Call for this November the 4th, 2012. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin and we're broadcasting live from the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA here in Ottawa. And we'll be taking your calls very soon at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. Now, I have a question for you, and it's more along the lines of where you stand on something, whether you think this is an appropriate venue to do this particular activity. And so I'll get into the details right now. I'm holding in my hand, and I showed this to our producer, Ted Raymond, just earlier, holding in my hand an orange cardboard, what they call a passport to our sponsors. It was at a conference that I was at earlier this week, a refresher course for family physicians on particular topics. And this card says, visit our sponsors for a chance to win a prize. Now, granted that a lot of conferences will have sponsors, aka drug companies, that provide financial contributions so that they can set up and provide this conference, although they do charge you for attending the conference as well. So what it says on this card, and I'm quoting directly from the card, it says, on the reverse side is a list of companies that have provided conference sponsorship. Please visit each booth and ask the company representative to stamp your card. Only one stamp is required for the 2 days. Once you have obtained all your stamps, and all is in boldface and underlined, please print your name and contact information and deposit your passport in the box on the registration table. The draw will be made at the end of the conference. Good luck. And then it says, I've collected stamps from all the sponsors. Please enter me in your draw to win! Exclamation mark. And on the back are the names of all the sponsors. Abbott, Ferring, Janssen Ortho, Login Canada, Mead Johnson, Merck, Pediapharm, Purdue, Sanofi Pasteur, and a couple of the conference resource centers from the particular institution providing the conference. So that was that. I looked at this and I chucked it away. When you go into the where the booths were set up was where you went to pick up to go for breakfast and lunch and snacks. And so you have this large room, and along the sides, all three of the four sides of the room, you have all the booths set up of the companies. And in the middle is set up where you line up to go and have your buffet, pick up your food and breakfast and such. And they don't come out and grab you. It's not a matter of them saying to you, oh, come see me, come speak to me. You have to go over there. So that's the setup. So every time you go in there, they're there looking at you as you go get your food. And and there are a lot of people who then go over to these booths that are providing whatever information on the products that they're trying to sell and promote. So my question to you is, you think this is a reasonable thing to be done at a conference? As somebody who is, I would assume most of my listeners are not physicians. So I want to know what your opinion is. What would you think of this kind of setup? If you know your physician goes to this and participates, is this a bad thing? Is this something, you know, they're getting information from the companies when they go to the conference? You know, or do you find it kind of odd that there's a passport that sort of encourages you to go because you may win a prize? Last time I checked, a lot of physicians were not bad off financially. I don't know what kind of prize they're offering or why that would be any significant incentive, but that's another matter altogether. So I'm curious to know whether you think this is, I'm just throwing it out there. My initial response, and I had my colleague with me, friend of mine, and I wrote on this card, you have no shame, was what I wrote on there. And I was going to give the card in just saying you have no shame. But that's my view. You may have a different view, and I encourage your opinion about that. On to other specific topics that are of actually really good interest. One was the American Heart Association publishing a new study in their journal Stroke that showed that people who regularly engaged in physical activity reduced their risk of vascular-related dementia. So those are tiny little clots that occur in the brain that cause literally brain damage over time. It reduced that risk by 40% and cognitive impairment of any sort. So that could be Alzheimer's, vascular dementias, all kinds of causes of dementia by 60%. And this protective effect of regular physical activity remained regardless of how old you were, what your education level was, changes in your brain's white matter. So even if there was some damage, and even previous history of stroke or diabetes, according to the researchers. This was a multinational European study that included yearly comprehensive cognitive assessments for 3 years. So that people weren't just asked how they were doing. Their cognitive abilities were tested every year. And they found that, according to Anna Verdello, MD, lead author of the study, and a neuroscience researcher at the University of Lisbon, Santa Maria Hospital in Portugal, she said, "We strongly suggest physical activity of moderate intensity for at least 30 minutes, 3 times a week, to prevent cognitive impairment. This is particularly important for people with vascular risk factors such as high blood pressure, stroke, or diabetes." The analysis was they took 639 people in their 60s and 70s. So that was the group, 60 and 70-year-olds, 55% women, 64% said they were active at least 30 minutes a day, 3 times a week. And the activities that they included were gym classes, walking and biking. So nothing overly strenuous. And from that, they then analyzed also using an MRI. They performed MRIs tests at the beginning and end of the study to gauge any white matter changes in the brain, which is where you'd see damage from blood vessels causing damage to the brain, that blood vessels get blocked up, small strokes, etc., as an indicator of possible cognitive decline. And they found that the exercise in and of itself reduced that particular risk. Now, the time frame was still relatively small. It was 3 years. But nevertheless, these are people in their 60s and 70s. 3 years amounts to a good chunk of a remaining lifespan. And you're reducing the risk of developing these changes and slowing it down and improving quality of life. So I thought that was really quite neat. The other story happens to be one, because we're in November and there's prostate cancer awareness, one about men suffering with prostate cancer. What is the best thing to do? Is it better for men who have low risk or non-aggressive or low growth or slow growing tumors to be watched instead of treated? And so that was the question that was asked, and 1,000 men who were diagnosed with prostate cancer were enrolled in this study. It was conducted at Sahlgrenska Academy at the University of Gothenburg in Sweden. And so what they did is they surmised, and what they're saying is that prostate cancer in many cases is slow growing. And many men never develop really any symptoms of this during their lifetime, which means that they may be treated unnecessarily. That is, they're biopsied, they're operated on, and they may be forced to live with serious side effects such as bowel disorders, problems with urination, and impotence. So they took 968 men from Sahlgrenska Academy, and they found many of the prostate cancer sufferers could dispense with treatment and avoid side effects if they instead opted to undergo active surveillance. And so this is what they found. Half of the men of those 968 opted for active surveillance as a treatment strategy, and the majority had low-risk tumors, so they very slow-growing tumors. But there were also some men with intermediate or high-risk tumors. And the results of the 440 men who chose just being watched, and active surveillance is doing biopsies and PSAs every year, and you're doing PSAs because they have cancer, not screening for cancer, because they have cancer and you want to see what's going to happen. So of the 440 men who chose the active surveillance, 60 died, but only one death was the result of prostate cancer. None of the men who had low-risk tumors developed any spread of their cancer or metastatic disease or died from the cancer. 63% of the men studied continued with active surveillance for the duration of the follow-up periods. That was 15 years. And 37% of those who chose active surveillance discontinued this in favor of treatment because The surveillance revealed that the tumor had grown. So they followed it. They did. They lived without any interventions until the tumor started showing changes, and then opted for the surgery. So the surveillance itself is for low-risk tumors. They said if the risk to men with intermediate or high-risk tumors and developing incurable or terminal cancer was four times greater than having a low-risk tumor. So they're not recommending the active surveillance for moderate to high-risk, but if in discussion with your physician you have low-risk prostate cancer, this may be a study to refer to and have a discussion about whether to be followed or to be treated. So that was very interesting because you're trying to reduce harm to people, especially if, in this case, many of the cancers, these prostate cancers, did not end up killing these men. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You are listening to Sunday House Call. We'll be taking your calls right after the break. 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is a long-distance number, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA.
As I have wandered through this world, and as each moment...
CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
And our lines are filling up, and we're going to go to line one and say good afternoon to Morris in Ottawa.
Hi, Dr. Dworkin.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Fine, thanks. I've been having a sore stomach for about a week, and my stomach is distended. I'm eating less. Only about half as much as usual, and I'm burping a fair bit. Now, just before this started, I had been having what I suppose is acid reflux, a sensation of stomach acid washing up into my throat,
right?
Usually when I was vertical or sitting, and I had been on taking ranitidine twice a day for a month, but it didn't seem to be changing the symptoms. But then I was to switch to Tecta.
Yep.
But then these symptoms that I just mentioned started, so I wasn't sure whether to start the Tecta or let things settle down. And I should mention that I'm under a fair bit of work stress lately, so I don't know if that's playing into this.
It certainly can. What you're describing, especially if the key issue with your history is that you had that acid taste in your mouth, so that certainly is reflux.
Okay.
And so excess acid production can be from, it could be work stress because it directly stimulates the nerves in the stomach to cause more acid secretion. That's a normal reflex to have.
Okay.
Coffee will do that too because of the caffeine.
Right.
Alcohol, wine, and beer, that also can contribute to the problem, as well as cigarette smoke.
I don't really consume any of those. But.
So that's good. The issue, though, is if you're already symptomatic, and that is you're getting bloating, you're getting you're burping more, you are getting that reflux symptoms, the acid will damage the esophagus, and it makes the esophagus spasm. That's the tube that runs from your mouth to your stomach, and can also over time lead to scarring. It doesn't mean it's going to happen overnight, but the issue is that the stomach has a lining that protects it from a pH of 3, which is, you know, to give you an idea, stomach acid being a pH of 3, vinegar is a pH of 5. So stomach acid is 100 times more acidic than vinegar is.
Okay.
So the lining of the esophagus does not have the same protective mucus layer and cells that can withstand the acid. So literally it gets burned. And so the idea is to reduce the amount of acid that's being produced in the stomach, which is what, in this case, you were given Tecta, which is, I believe, pantoprazole.
Yes.
And it will, this is a medication that's called a proton pump inhibitor. What it means is that it blocks the cells that literally pump acid out into your stomach. It blocks the channels that do that, and thereby reducing the acid content in the stomach and giving the tissues a chance to heal up. If you're symptomatic, that is, you're getting bloated, that's because the acid in your stomach, in part, is reacting with the food that you're eating, and as a result, you get bloated, and it's also very uncomfortable, and that's why you're burping a lot more.
Okay.
So ideally, if you were prescribed the Tecta and you haven't used it yet, it's probably a good idea, if it was prescribed by a physician, to then follow that instruction.
Okay.
Because it will, within a few days, it will reduce the acid in your stomach. You still may have some discomfort, but that's also because of the damage caused by the acid in the first place. And it takes the tissues at least a couple of weeks, especially in the esophagus, to really settle down. And overall, usually we recommend if somebody is symptomatic and they've had discomfort and possible damage, that it's taken for at least 2 months and then the person can stop.
Okay.
But you'd have to talk to your doctor about that to make sure that that's the thing that they want you to do.
Right.
But ideally, what you're doing is you're temporarily suspending acid production to a point that allows the tissue to heal. It's not going to interfere with your ability to digest food. It likely is going to reduce the bloating. And also, I don't know if you've been experiencing any intestinal cramps or loose stools or
no. Well, I had the stomach cramps, but bowel habits are unaffected so far.
Okay, that's good, because a lot of times the acid will go into the will travel down the intestine and also irritate it as well.
Okay.
So the ranitidine is a bit different. Ranitidine is what we call a histamine 2 receptor blocker. Histamine 2 is it's an antihistamine, a type of antihistamine, but it works on histamine molecules that attach to the stomach cell to then allow the stomach cell to produce, tells it, okay, pump out the acid. So it tries to block that, but it's not as effective as blocking the pump in and of itself.
Okay.
And so that's why the ranitidine may not work as well as the proton pump inhibitor.
Great. Thank you. And what are the indications for a scope evaluation?
Usually a scope is done only if treatment, the standard conventional treatments, have not produced a desirable reduction in morbidity. That is, you take the medication and it just hasn't worked at all. You know, you even double the medication and it still hasn't reduced the acid. You're still getting pain. You're still getting reflux. And then you'll tend to do a scope, because sometimes you want to rule out whether there's something called a hiatus hernia. That is a portion of the stomach that comes up above the diaphragm, which separates your chest from your abdomen. And so the valve that normally would prevent the acid from migrating upwards into the esophagus now is not functional. And so the stomach is making acid, and the acid is freely flowing up into the chest, into the esophagus. And so a scope would be done to look and see if that was happening. But otherwise, we try not to do too much invasive stuff until you try suppressing the acid, because it usually is quite effective. And it's an ordeal to have that test done. I've had it done. It's just not a pleasant thing to have done at all.
Okay.
So it's only done if the symptoms persist, or under circumstances where they suspect some pathology going on in the stomach. You know, if someone has bleeding, or they're coughing up blood, or there's something that is much more ominous, they'll do the scope. But for reflux, where there is what we call water brash, which is what you described, where you get the acidy taste in your throat, you get some heartburn, you get the bloating. Usually, you treat that first, especially in the absence of any blood or bleeding or changes in stool color. Then you just leave that person alone. You treat them. The other thing that might be helpful is doing what we call an H. pylori test.
Right, that has been done. I haven't heard the results yet.
Okay, and so that tells us whether there's a bacteria. It's usually more, it's associated with ulcer disease and not necessarily reflux. But nevertheless, it's done as a means of looking to see if someone is colonized with it, because this bacteria stimulates the stomach to produce acid, because the stomach's trying to destroy the bacteria.
Right.
So you get more acid production, and eliminating that particular bacteria is curative in about 95-96% of the time with a first time treatment for it, which uses two different antibiotics and the proton pump inhibitor. It tends to get rid of it completely. It was interesting because it was a Nobel Prize winning research that
really?
Did that. It was the Dr. Stephen Marshall out of Australia.
Okay.
That he actually treated himself as a guinea pig, because no one believed him,
right,
that he thought this bacteria was the principal cause for ulcer disease.
Mm.
And so he took the H. pylori and he drank it.
Oh, yeah.
And he gave himself an ulcer.
Okay.
And he then showed that you could eliminate the bacteria and then get rid of the symptoms. And so that won him the Nobel Prize.
Fantastic. And you mentioned change in stool color. I do notice my output a bit more yellowish lately. Is that related?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
The color changes, you get yellow or brown, is usually the result of the production of bilirubin coming out of the gallbladder when you eat. And so if you're not eating very much, you don't stimulate as much of that bile acid being secreted into the bowel, and so you may see some color change that way. It's more if the stool has blood in it, or if it is turning really really black. That is literally black as like a black star, a black night, that kind of black. Okay. And that signifies that there's some bleeding and the blood is being digested and turning black, turning the stool black.
Okay. That's fantastic. Thank you so much, Dr. Dworkin.
You're very welcome, Morris.
Okay, bye-bye.
All the best. Bye-bye now. And we're going to take a small break for the news. We have Helen in Ottawa, who would like to talk about last week's show where we discussed travel medicine. Norma would like to discuss osteoarthritis pain medications. Joe in Douglas, Ontario, has some questions about ultrasound side effects. And Chris in Ottawa has questions about adult acne. We'll get to all your questions right after the news, and that's a great jazzy tune. Thanks, Ted. And we will be back in a couple of minutes. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You are listening to Sunday House Call. News is up.
580 CFRA Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com. The advice and recommendations in this program are for general educational purposes and not a diagnosis. You should consult a physician or health professional directly before beginning or changing any course of health treatment. Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA.
Dr. Parkinson declared, I'm not surprised to see you here. You've got smokers cough from smoking, brewers droop from drinking beer. I don't know how you came to get the Betty Davis knees, but worst of all, young man, you've got a nostril disease. He wrote me a prescription, he said, you are depressed. I'm glad you came to see me to get this off your chest. Come back and see me later. Next patient, please. Send in another victim of nostril disease.
521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. And a good afternoon to Helen in Ottawa.
Hello.
Hi.
Is it Helen?
Yes.
Yes. Dr. Dworkin, I just wanted to thank you for your advice last week in which I told you about a friend of mine who has what they thought was blastocytosis.
Right.
Had been going on for some time, and
yes,
he'd lost 20 pounds, etc.
Right. This was on Rob Snow show this past Wednesday.
Yes.
Yes.
And your advice was to look beyond the plasto and at the whole person,
correct,
etc. And he went to the emergency at the Civic and had some tests. Came home, received a call to go back in fast. So he's in hospital now and being, cared for and investigated and everything. And I'm so grateful.
So for your
advice.
Well, you're very welcome. Did they found something different? Is there something?
Nothing has been found yet.
But
a lot of tests, MRIs.
Okay.
Also, CTs, everything.
Good. Well, I'm glad. Well, they obviously must have saw something going further.
It had gone on so long.
Right. Well, I'm glad that he's getting the care now, Helen. It just sounded like he was suffering and just not sort of just languishing.
Well, I think your advice was just the kick to do the right thing and in there.
I'm glad it's worked out at least at this point for him.
Thank you.
You're very
so
welcome.
Much.
Thank you very much, Helen.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long-distance number. And we have line 3, Norma in Ottawa. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Dr. Dworkin.
How are you?
Well, not too bad, thank you.
Okay.
And I wish to ask you,
sure.
I do have reflux, and I'm careful with that diet. But anyway, I'm calling about a medication for osteoarthritis pain, and so it's confusing. You go in a drugstore like glucosamine Crondin, it comes in a 500 milligram or 900 milligram. 900, you take 3 a day. They're rather large.
Yes, they are large.
And then in addition to, I have reflux, as I said.
Yeah.
I'm very careful with the diet. I've been on Losec for about 7 years.
Okay.
And in addition, now I am wakened every night. I had an MRI 2 years ago. I have thinning of the cartilage below one knee, so that pain wakes me up, but I don't think it's arthritis. Anyway, I wondered, like, whether I did take, now, I tried glucosamine condon, and however, after about 2 weeks, then 2 days in a row, I took sudden pain of esophagus. So I stopped them. You know, I wondered if that was the reason I took that severe esophagus pain.
It's unlikely that that caused the esophageal pain that you're describing.
I see.
The glucosamine is, there is some evidence to suggest that glucosamine taken about 500 milligrams three times a day is somewhat effective for mild to almost moderate osteoarthritic pain. It doesn't do too much if it's severe osteoarthritis. So it might be helpful.
I see.
Usually, though, to treat pain from osteoarthritis usually requires several, it's attacked from several different directions. One is to stay as active as possible, obviously, to try and keep the joints moving so they don't stiffen up. The second is adequate pain management. And by adequate pain management, it doesn't mean taking a whole bunch of medications, but rather trying to find out which medication tends to work well to get the person to a point where they can be as active as they would like to be, even though they may still experience a bit of pain. It's pain that is bearable. And so when we talk about pain management, it's never to get pain down to zero, because in order to do that, it usually requires a lot of heavy dosing of medications, especially if a person is suffering from severe disease.
So
really what we tend to do is we ask a person on a scale of 1 to 10 where they rate their pain, and 10 being their worst pain they've ever had and 1 being the least type of pain. And so if someone is usually reporting that they're around 2, 3, or 4, they're usually okay with that. It's when it gets into 5 and up that they find that it really blocks their ability or prevents them from being active. And so that's sort of the goal. So that way you're avoiding overdoing it with medications. You're still getting a person down to a point where they can move around and exercise, which only further helps them out. So my question then to you is this the only medication you're using right now? And how effective is it if you're going to rate your pain from, say, from 1 to 10?
I see. Well, no, I did stop after the 2 days of the esophagus pain. I stopped the glucosamine. I was taking like a 900 three times a day.
Right.
So, but I could then now try 500. And as you mentioned, and go from there, perhaps.
Sure. How was your pain, though, when you were taking it? Was it okay?
Well, I felt an improvement, yes.
Okay. And so, and again, how would you rate that? You know, if 10 is your worst pain and 1 is the least, where would you have rated the pain when you were taking the medication as opposed to when you're not taking the medication?
Okay. I'd say the pain was like maybe 4.
Okay.
Taking it. And prior to that, maybe 7.
Okay, so it was helping you, and were you able to do everything that you wanted to do while you were taking the medication? You know, to with your activities and just being able to function.
Yes, I think so. And now I'm doing a Nordic pole walk.
Oh, that's fantastic!
Right, but I did have a couple of bad sessions.
Right.
Of pain afterwards, so I did ask my doctor, and, you know, I have to kind of take it easy and not push it type of thing.
Right, okay, but if the glucosamine was helping you and your pain went from 7 to 4, there's certainly no reason why you couldn't resume that. It's not going to be what's responsible for the stomach problem. We know that you have acid reflux.
Yes.
And sometimes, despite taking medication, you can sometimes have days where you'll have excess acid anyway, and that can cause the esophageal spasm or discomfort. So nothing remains completely the same all the time. Even when we take medications, diseases and disease conditions will have their peaks and valleys. And so despite medication use, sometimes those peaks exceed what the medication is able to do, and you have those particular symptoms for those couple of days.
I see. I see. Oh, I very much appreciate everything you've told me, Dr. Dorr.
Oh, you're very welcome, Norma.
Thanks very much. Your show is so helpful.
Thank you. And stay active with the Nordic walking. That's terrific.
Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long-distance number. And we're going to line 7. And Joe in Douglas, Ontario, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Doctor.
How are you?
Oh, not too bad. For an old fella.
Okay.
I'll tell you what I'm calling about.
Sure.
Is between 2 and 4 years ago, I had an ultrasound for abdomen, pelvis. I was having some problems in that area.
Okay.
And halfway through the ultrasound, I went to empty my bladder.
Mm-hmm.
I was peeing blood.
Mm-hmm.
So then I come back and I told the technician. She said, "Oh, I'll just put it on the report."
Yeah.
Well, when I come out of there, my stomach was so sore, and I was like that for nearly a year. Finally, I was peeing blood back and forth, and I'd go into emergency, and not much was getting done. So finally I went to a urologist that I knew, and he operated on my prostate again there, routed it out there. So and that kind of stopped everything.
Okay.
But now I'm going to have to go for another one. They want me to go for another one, and I'm coming to kind of hesitating about, because I was a year suffering, and nothing got done.
Well, I think this is a matter of, the ultrasound is unlikely to have caused the stomach problem. And the reason is that the beam is not strong enough to cause tissue damage. But you do raise a good point, Joe, is that there are ultrasound devices that focus the ultrasound to destroy tissue. For example, they'll use it to destroy fibroids for women who have fibroids in the uterus. They'll even use it to treat some prostate conditions. But it's a very specialized machine. It's not an ultrasound machine per se that gives you a picture. It's an ultrasound beam that comes from different directions and focuses on one small area to heat up the tissue. But the pain that you are having, especially if your urologist did a transurethral prostatic resection, or a TURP, which is what you mentioned, where they core out the prostate, with a prostate that is enlarged, it causes the bladder to distend. And that distension can cause the pain that you are experiencing, especially you had blood in the urine, you had symptoms, and you likely were suffering for a year with this condition that was only getting worse over time. The other issue is that because you had to drink so much for the ultrasound and then go to the bathroom, you likely distended your bladder. And because the prostate itself was damaged, you may have distended the bladder more than it should have become, and it remained like that or remained damaged and continued to give you that pain.
Because it was so bad I could hardly wear the trousers around my waist.
Yeah, so I think that I don't think you should be concerned too much about another ultrasound, because what they want to do is look at the prostate again and look at the bladder, but rather you have a urologist now that knows you have a specific condition, and they're likely to offer other treatments on the basis of this, because what they want to do is see how things have progressed.
No, I have changed urologists, and what he wants, the reason he wants this is he wants to check the big arteries in my tummy, and that's what he wants to do, wants the ultrasound for.
Oh, he wants to check and see if you have an aneurysm.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So I would definitely go ahead with that ultrasound. I wouldn't.
Now, do I have to hold a whole lot of water in my bladder?
Not for that one.
Not for that one?
This is an abdominal ultrasound, so you won't have to do the fluid in the bladder, because they're looking at the arteries and not the bladder itself.
So you think I won't come out with
you won't come out with the stomach problem, Joe. I can almost guarantee you that, because you're not taking any more water in, and really all you're doing is lying down, and they're putting an ultrasound on the abdomen. They're not going to damage any organs by doing that.
Yeah. Okay, good. Thank you very kindly, Doctor.
You're very welcome, Joe.
Okay, goodbye.
All the best. Bye-bye. Take a small break, and we'll be back with your calls. You're listening to Sunday House Call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin on 580 CFRA. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call. News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call. News Talk Radio 580, CFRA.
Talk 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. And we're going to line four, and good afternoon to Chris in Ottawa.
Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, I had a question for you about acne.
Yes.
I've had it for most of my childhood, and I'm 25 now, and I'm getting tired of it.
Okay.
I've tried a lot of stuff on the market. The only thing I haven't done was go to a doctor and get a stronger prescription of that salicylic acid.
Right.
But all that does is really dry out my face extremely and just irritate it. So I was wondering if you had any home remedies or something I could mix together myself.
It's unlikely there's going to be any home remedies, Chris, that are going to help, but there are new products that are out on the market that won't dry out your face as much and also help control the acne. Is it just on the face, or do you also have it on the back?
I have it on the back of my shoulders. So
okay. And are they small pimples, or they get large and they get really filled up with the oils and the sebum? Like, do they break well, open at times? Or
to be honest, it's yeah. not as bad as it used to. It hasn't been as bad as it used to be in about 5 years.
Okay.
But it's sometimes they're big and sometimes they're small.
Okay. Well, there are a lot of topical agents that can be used that don't have the drying agent in them. Your physician can certainly give you one that has just an antibiotic that you can use that goes on the face. There are also other topical agents that don't dry out the skin as much. But the problem with the over-the-counter stuff is that they're relatively weak. They may help for some very mild acne, but when there's more widespread acne, or it's persisting into adulthood, there are the over-the-counter stuff doesn't work that great. But there has been a major upgrade in what is available for treating acne now, especially for adults. And as I said, a lot of the products now don't have to dry out the skin. The ones that tend to dry out the skin a lot are what we call the vitamin A acid derivatives, or the retinoids. And so these have different strengths. And a lot of times what tends to happen is if a person is given a retinoid cream or gel that is too strong, the skin gets red, it starts to peel, and almost looks like it gets burned. But there are much weaker ones that are available that can be started. Doesn't mean that this is what's going to be given to you, but I'm just giving an idea that what used to be given in the past is not necessarily what is done now. Now what we tend to do is give the weakest one, or depending on a person's skin type, something that won't cause the same side effect, and you can gradually increase the dose or increase the strength over time. Or you can also use the other topical agents that don't have the vitamin A acid derivative in it. They're not retinoids, and also help clear up the acne. And again, there's the topical antibiotic stuff as well that also works. So there's a whole range of things that are available now. And you really shouldn't have to suffer with this, Chris. I mean, I know I had acne all my life as well, and I had to use the really strong stuff when I was in my 20s. It was called Accutane, which works great, but it's literally the hammer for acne. I had really bad disfiguring cystic acne on the face and on the back, and it worked really well at eliminating the acne. And I still get acne from time to time, but it's nothing like it used to be. So the point being is that there is a lot of stuff that's available, and so the experience that you had before with the use of these things is not necessarily the same experience you're going to have this time around.
So I also heard there was a pill. Is that true? I also heard there was a pill that you could take, a prescription.
Well, that's the Accutane, which is really only, it's really for people that have disfiguring acne or scarring on the face where the acne is causing damage, or There is what we call pustular acne, where you have these large, literally cysts filled with pus on the face. Or in some cases, it's just widespread, and all the agents that have been used prior to that, all the topical stuff, hasn't worked. And so that's what that's for. There is another pill that is used, which is an antibiotic. It's called minocycline or tetracycline is another one. Those are antibiotics that are taken for usually 28 days or longer to try and clear up or kill the bacteria that's growing in the acne to reduce the acne. So those are the two oral medications that can be used. But really, those are reserved in the event that the topicals don't work, because again, you want to go from you want to start off at a point where you're doing the least potential harm to then, and you gradually move up the ladder to more and more stronger agents.
Okay. Just one last question, and I'm pretty sure it's, you're going to say it's probably terrible not to do it, but I heard that if I took ammonia and I put it in a bowl and put a towel over my head, kind of like when you do when you're sick,
not sticking,
obviously, but just blowing and letting it dry out my skin, would that be okay?
No, ammonia can be corrosive and actually burn your skin. So I would not do that, Chris. Save yourself the agony.
All right.
All the best. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
My thanks for Ted Raymond producing Sunday House Call. And once again, your call is always terrific. My apologies to Rob. We have completely run out of time, as we have about 15 or 14 seconds left now. You have been listening to Sunday House Call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. We'll be back next week with another edition. Have a great week, everybody.